you guys. But when Mercer finds out, he'll want to jump in with everything he has. Cameras, microphones, the FBI waiting in the wings. If we are wrong, Jenks'll sue our ass, Jill said. I don't even want to think about it. And Cleveland'll be waiting, said Claire. Make us look like a bunch of fools. Finally, Jill sighed. All right. I'm with you, Lindsay. If you can't think of another way. I looked at all three of them to make certain we were unanimous. Suddenly, Cindy burst in. Can you give me another 24 hours? I looked at her. I don't know, why? Just until tomorrow. And I need Jenks's social security number. I shook my head. You heard what I said about McBride. Anyway, for what? She had that same look as the other night when she burst into my apartment, holding the photo of Jenks and Kathy Kogut, the third bride. Just give me until tomorrow morning. Then she got up and left. Chapter 83. The following morning, Cindy sheepishly pushed open the glass doors leading to the office of the San Francisco Writers Guild. This felt a lot like the day at the Grand Hyatt. At the reception desk, a middle-aged woman with the punctilious look of a librarian looked up at her. May I help you? Cindy took in a deep breath. I need to find a manuscript. It was written quite a while ago. The word copyright had set her off. She had written short stories in college. They were barely good enough to get into the school's literary journal, but her mother had insisted, get them copyrighted. When she investigated, it turned out it took months and was way too costly. But a friend who had published told her about another way she could register documents locally. He told her, all the writers do. If Nicholas Jenks had wanted to protect himself in his salad days, he might have gone the same route. It's sort of a family thing, Cindy told the woman. My brother wrote this history. Going back three generations, we don't have a copy. The woman shook her head. This isn't the library, hun. I'm afraid that whatever we have here is restricted. If you want to find it, you'll have to have your brother come in. I can't, Cindy said solemnly. Nick is dead. The woman softened, looked at her slightly less officiously. I'm sorry. His wife said she can't locate a copy. I'd like to give it to our dad, a 60th birthday present. She felt guilty, foolish, lying through her teeth like this, but everything was riding on getting this book. There's a process for all of this, the woman replied sanctimoniously. Death certificate, proof of next of kin. The family lawyer should be able to help you. I just can't go letting you in here. Cindy's mind raced. This wasn't exactly Microsoft here. If she had found her way to the crime scene at the Grand Hyatt, tracked Lindsay to the second crime, she ought to be able to handle this. Everyone was counting on her. There must be a way you can let me take a look, please. I'm afraid not, dear. Not without some documentation. What makes you even think it's registered with us? My sister-in-law is sure it is. Well, I can't just go giving out registered documents on someone's hunch, she said with finality. Maybe you can at least look it up, Cindy proposed, to see if it's even here. The dachshund-nosed defender of the free press finally relaxed. I guess I can do that. You say it was several years ago? Cindy felt an adrenaline surge. Yes. And the name? I think it was called Always a Bridesmaid. She felt a chill just saying the words. I meant the name of the author, please. Jenks, Cindy said, holding her breath. Nicholas Jenks. The woman peered at her. The mystery writer? Cindy shook her head, faked a smile. The insurance salesman, she said as calmly as she could. The woman gave her a strange look, but continued to punch in the name. You have proof of relationship? Cindy handed her a piece of paper with Jenks's social security number on it. This should be on his registration. That won't do, the woman said. Cindy fumbled through a zipper in her knapsack. She felt the moment slipping away. At least tell me if it's here. I'll come back later with whatever you want. Jenks, the woman muttered skeptically. Looks like your brother was a bit more prolific than you thought. He's got three manuscripts registered here. Cindy wanted to let out a shout. The only one I'm looking for is called Always a Bridesmaid. It took what seemed like several minutes, but the stony resistance on the woman's face finally weakened. I don't know why I'm doing this, but if you can verify your story, there seems to be a record of that manuscript's being here.
Cindy felt a surge of validation. The manuscript was the final piece they needed to crack a murder case and put away Jinx. Now, she just had to get it out.
Chapter 84.
I found it! Exclaimed Cindy, her voice breathless on the phone. Always a bridesmaid! I pounded my desk in elation. This meant we could definitely make our move. So what does it say, Cindy?
I found it, Cindy clarified. I just don't actually have it.
She told me about the Writers Guild. The book was there, but it would take a little coaxing to actually get it into our hands. It took barely 2 hours, starting with a frantic call to Jill. She had a judge pulled out of chambers, and we had our court order mandating the release of Jinx's manuscript, Always a Bridesmaid. Then Jill and I ran down to meet Cindy. On the way, I made one more call, to Claire. It seemed fitting that all of us should be there.
20 minutes later, Jill and I met Cindy and Claire in front of a drab building on Geary where the Writers Guild maintained its offices. Together, we rode to the 8th floor.
I'm back, announced Cindy to a surprised woman behind the reception desk. And I brought my documentation.
She eyed us suspiciously. Who are these, cousins? I flashed the clerk my badge and also presented the officially stamped search warrant.
What's going on with this book? The woman gasped.
Clearly out of her authority, she went inside and came back with a supervisor who read over the court order.
We usually only hold them for up to 8 years, he said with some uncertainty.
Then he disappeared for what seemed a lifetime. We all sat there in the Stark reception area like pacing relatives waiting for a baby to be born.
What if it had been thrown out?
Finally, the supervisor came out with a dusty bundle wrapped in brown paper.
In the back of the bins, he announced with a self-satisfied smile.
There was a coffee shop right down the street. We took a table in back and crowded around with anticipation. I plopped the manuscript down on the table, peeled off the brown paper wrapping. I read the cover. Always a Bridesmaid, a novel by Nicholas Jinx. Nervously, I opened it and read the first page. The narrator was reflecting on his crimes from jail. His name was Philip Campbell.
What is the worst thing, the novel began, anyone has ever done?
Chapter 85. We split up the book into 4 sections. We each paged silently, searching for some scene or detail that would parallel the real-life crimes. Mine was about this guy's life, Philip Campbell, his picture-perfect wife catching her with another man. He killed them both, and his life changed forever.
Bingo! Jill spoke up suddenly. She read out loud, bending back the sheaf of paper like a deck of cards.
She described a scene with Philip Campbell. Breath pounding inside, voices ringing in his head, stealing through the halls of a hotel. The Grand Hyatt. A bride and groom in a suite. Campbell breaks in on them. He kills them without a second thought.
In a single act, Jill read from the manuscript, he had washed away the stench of betrayal and replaced it with a fresh, heretofore unimagined desire. He liked to kill.
Our eyes locked. This was beyond creepy. Jinx was crazy. But was he also crafty? Claire was next. It was another wedding, this time outside a church. The bride and groom coming down the steps, rice being thrown, shouts of congratulations, applause. The same man, Philip Campbell, at the wheel of the limo that will take them away. We looked at one another, stunned. It was how the second murders were committed. Jill murmured, "Holy shit." Claire just shook her head. She looked sad and shocked. I guess we all were. A long-suppressed cry of satisfaction built up in my chest. We had done it. We had solved the bride and groom murders. I wonder how it ends, Cindy mused, fanning to the end of the book.
How else, said Jill, with an arrest.
Chapter 86. I rode up to Jenks's house with Chris Raleigh. We barely spoke, both of us brimming with anticipation.
Outside, we were met by Charlie Clapper and his CSU team. They would grid-search the house and grounds as soon as we took Jenks in. We rang the bell. Each second I waited, my heart pounded harder. Every reason I became a cop was grinding in my chest. This was it. The door opened, and the same housekeeper answered. This time her eyes went wide as she took in the convergence of blue and whites outside. I flashed my badge. We need to see Mr. Jenks. We made our way back toward the sitting room where we had met Jenks only the day before. A startled Chessie Jenks met us in the hall.
Inspector, she gasped, recognizing me. What's going on? What are all those police cars doing out front?
I'm sorry, I said, meeting her eyes. I was sorry for her. Is your husband at home?
Nick!
She cried, realizing in a panic why we had come. Then she ran along with us, trying to block me, shouting,
You can't just come in here like this! This is our home!
Please, Mrs. Jenks, Raleigh implored. I was too wound up to stop. I wanted Nicholas Jenks so bad it hurt. A second later he appeared, coming in from the back lawn overlooking the Pacific. He was holding a golf club.
I thought I told you, he said, looking perfectly unruffled in his white shirt and linen shorts. The next time you need something from me, you should contact my lawyer.
You can tell him yourself, I said. My heart was racing. Nicholas Jenks, you are under arrest for the murders of David and Melanie Brandt, Michael and Rebecca DeGeorge, James and Kathleen Voskuhl. I wanted him to hear every name, to bring to mind every one of them he'd killed. I wanted to see the callous indifference crack in his eyes.
This is insane!
Jenks glared at me, his gray eyes burned with intensity.
Nick! Cried his wife. What are they talking about? Why are they here in our house?
Do you know what you're doing?
He asked, the veins bulging on his neck.
I asked you, do you have any idea what you're doing?
I didn't answer, just recited the Miranda warning.
What you're doing, he raged, is engaging in the biggest mistake of your little life.
What are they saying?
His wife was pale. Nick, please tell me, what is going on?
Shut up!
Jenks spat out at her. Suddenly he spun back toward me with a vicious fire in his eyes. He lunged forward with his fist. He swung at me. I cut his feet out from under him. Jenks fell across an end table to the floor, photos falling everywhere, glass shattering. The writer moaned loudly in pain. Chessie Jenks screamed, stood there in a paralyzed state. Chris Raleigh cuffed her husband and dragged him to his feet.
"Call Sherman!" Jenks shouted at his wife. "Tell him where I am. What's happened?"
Raleigh and I pushed Jenks out to our car. He continued to struggle, and I saw no reason to be gentle.
"What's your theory on the murders now?"
I asked him. Chapter 87. After the last news conference had ended, after the last flashbulb had dimmed, after I had rehashed for what seemed the 100th time how we had narrowed in on Jenks, after a beaming Chief Mercer had been chauffeured away, I hugged Claire, Cindy, and Jill. I then passed on a celebratory beer and wandered back to the Hall of Justice. It was well past 8, and only the prattle of the night shift interrupted my being alone. I sat at my desk in the well-earned silence of the squad room and tried to remember the last time I felt this good. Tomorrow we would begin meticulously compiling the case against Nicholas Jenks, interrogating him, accumulating more evidence, filing out report after report. But we had done it. We had caught him, just as I had hoped we eventually would. I had fulfilled the promise I made to Melanie Brandt that horrible night in the Mandarin suite at the Grand Hyatt. I felt proud of myself. Whatever happened with Negley's, even if I never made lieutenant, no one could take this away. I got up, stepped over to the freestanding blackboard that listed the cases we were working on. Under open cases, somewhere near the top, was her name, Melanie Brandt. I took the eraser and rubbed her name, then her husband's, until they disappeared, until the blue smear of chalk was no more.
I bet you that feels good.
Raleigh's voice sounded behind me. I turned. He was there, looking smug. What are you doing here, I asked, so late.
Thought I'd straighten up Roth's desk, steal a few brownie points, he said.
What do you think, Lindsay? I came to find you. We were in a corner of the squad room, and there was no one around. He never had to move. I went to him. Nothing in the way. No reason to deny this. I kissed him. Not like before. Not just to let Chris know I was interested. I kissed him the way I had wanted him to kiss me that night in Cleveland. I wanted to steal the breath right out of him. I wanted to say, I wanted to do this from the first time I saw you. When we finally pulled apart, he repeated with a smile, like I said, I bet that feels good.
It did feel good. Right now, it all felt good. It also felt unavoidable.
What are your plans? I smiled at him.
How loosely are we talking?
Specifically, right now. Tonight. The next several hours, at least.
I thought I would come back, straighten Cheery's desk, and see if you wanted me to take you home.
Let me get my purse. Chapter 88. I don't know how we got all the way to my apartment in the Potrero. I don't know how Chris and I talked and drove and ignored what was tearing at us inside. Once we got through my door, there was no stopping it. I was all over Chris. He was all over me. We only got as far as the rug in the foyer, kissing, touching, fumbling for buttons and zippers, breathing loudly. I had forgotten how good it was to be held, to be desired by somebody I wanted, too. Once we touched, we knew enough to take our time. We both wanted it to last. Chris had what I needed more than anything else. Soft hands. I loved kissing him. Loved his touch, his gentleness, then his roughness. The simple fact that he was concerned about my pleasure as much as his own. You never know until you try it out. But I loved being with Chris. I absolutely loved it. I know it's a cliché, but that night I made love as if it might never happen again. I felt Chris's current warming me, electrifying, from my womb to my thighs to the tips of my fingers and my toes. His grasp was all that held me together, kept me from breaking apart. I felt a trust for him that was unquestioning. I held nothing back. I gave myself to Chris in a way I never had to anyone before. Not only with my body and my heart. These were things I could pull back. I gave him my hope that I could still live. When I cried out, tremors exploding inside me, my fingers and toes stiff with joy, a voice inside me whispered what I knew was true. I gave him everything. He gave it back. Finally, Chris pulled off me. We were both tingling, still on fire.
What?
I gasped for breath.
Now what?
He looked at me and smiled. I want to see the bedroom. Chapter 89. A cool breeze was blowing in my face. Oh, God, what a night. What a day. What a roller coaster. I sat wrapped in a quilt out on my terrace overlooking the south end of the bay. Nothing moving, only the lights of San Leandro in the distance. It was 2:15. In the bedroom, Chris lay asleep. He'd earned some rest. I couldn't sleep. My body was too alive, tingling like a distant shore with 1,000 flickering lights. I couldn't help but smile at the thought. It had been a great day. June 27th, I said aloud. I'm gonna remember you. First, we find the book. Then, we arrest Jenks. I never imagined it could go any further. But it had. It went way further. Chris and I had made love that night twice more. The last 3 hours, a sweet dance of touching, panting, loving. I didn't want to feel Chris's hands ever leave me. I didn't ever want to miss the heat of his body. It was a new, electrifying sensation. For once, I had held nothing back, and that was very, very good. But here, in the dark of the night, an accusing voice needled me. I was lying. I hadn't given it all. There was the one inescapable truth that I was hiding. I hadn't told him about Negley's. I didn't know how to. Just as we had felt such life, how could I tell him I might be dying? That my body, which a moment ago was so alive with passion, was infected. In a single day, it seemed that everything in my life was transformed. I wanted to soar. I deserved it. I deserved to be happy. But he deserved to know. I heard a rustling behind me. It was Chris.
"What are you doing out here?"
he asked. He came up behind me, placed his hands on my neck and shoulders. I was hugging my knees, the quilt barely covering my breasts. "It's gonna be hard," I said, leaning my head on him, "to go back to the way things were."
"Who said anything about going back?"
"I mean, like partners, watching you across the room. Tomorrow we have to interrogate Jenks. Big day for both of us."
His fingers teased my breasts, then the back of my neck. He was driving me crazy. "You don't have to worry," he said. "Once the case is made, I'm going back. I'll stick around for the interrogation."
"Chris," I said, as a chill shot through me. I had gotten used to him.
"I told you we weren't going to be partners forever."
He bent down, inhaling the smell of my hair.
"At least, not that kind of partners."
"What kind does that leave?" I murmured. My neck was on fire where his hands caressed me. "Oh, let this go somewhere," I begged inside. "Let this go all the way to the moon." Could I just tell him? It was no longer that I couldn't find a way. It was just, now that we were here, I didn't want it to end. I let him take me into the bedroom.
"This keeps getting better and better," I whispered.
"Doesn't it? I can't wait to see what happens next."
Chapter 90. I had just gotten to my desk the following morning. I was flipping the Chronicle to the continuation of Cindy's article on Jenks's arrest when my phone rang. It was Charlie Clapper. His crime scene team had spent most of the night meticulously going over everything in Jenks's house. "You make a case for me, Charlie?" I was hoping for a murder weapon, maybe even the missing rings, something solid that would melt Jenks's sneering defiance. The CSU leader let out a weary breath.
"I think you should come down here and see."
I grabbed my purse and the keys to our work car. In the hallway, I ran into Jacoby.
"Rumors say," he grunted, "I'm no longer the man of your dreams."
"You know, you should never believe what you read in the Star," I quipped.
"Right. Or hear from the night shift."
I pulled myself to a stop. Someone had spotted Chris and me last night. My mind flashed through the red-hot copy that was probably running through the office rumor mill. Behind my anger, I knew that I was blushing.
"Relax," Jacoby said. "You know what can happen when you get caught up in a good collar. And it was a good collar."
"Thank you, Warren," I said. It was one of those rare moments when neither of us had anything to hide. I winked and hit the stairs.
"Just remember," he called after me, "it was the champagne match that got you on your way."
"I remember. I'm grateful. Thank you, Warren." I drove down 6th to Taylor in California to Jenks's home in Seacliff. When I arrived, two police cars were blocking the street, keeping a circle of media vans at bay. I found Clapper, looking weary and unshaven, catching a brief rest at the dining room table. "You find me a murder gun?" I asked.
"Just these."
He pointed to a pile of guns in plastic bags on the floor. There were hunting rifles, a showcase Minelli shotgun, a Colt automatic 45 pistol. No 9mm. I didn't make a move to examine them.
"We went through his office," Clapper wheezed. "Nothing on any of the victims. No clippings, no trophies."
"I was hoping you might have come across the missing rings."
"You want rings?" Clapper said. He wearily pushed himself up. "His wife's got rings. Plenty of them. I'll let you go through them. But what we did find was this. Follow me."
On the floor of the kitchen, with a yellow evidence marker on it, was a crate of wine. Champagne. Krug. Claude Duménil. "That we already knew," I said. He kept looking at me as if I had somehow insulted him with the obvious. Then he lifted a bottle out of the open case.
Check the numbers, Lindsay. Each bottle's registered with a number. Look here. 423559. Must make it go down all the more smoothly.
He took out a folded-up green copy of a police property voucher from his chest pocket.
The one from the Hyatt.
Same lot.
Same number.
Charlie smiled. The bottles were the same. It was solid evidence that tied Jenks to where David and Melanie Brandt were killed. It wasn't a weapon, but it was damning, no longer circumstantial. A rush of excitement shot through me. I high-fived the pale, heavy-set CSU man.
"Anyway," Charlie said almost apologetically, "I wouldn't have brought you all the way out here for just that."
Clapper led me through the finely furnished interior of the house to the master bedroom. It had a vast picture window looking out on the Golden Gate Bridge. He took me into a spacious closet. Jenks's.
"You remember the bloody jacket we found at the hotel?"
In the rear of the closet, Charlie squatted over a large shoe rack.
"Well, now it's a set."
Clapper reached behind the shoe rack and pulled out a crumpled Nordstrom's shopping bag.
"I wanted you to see how we found it."
Out of the bag, he pulled balled-up black tuxedo trousers.
"I already checked. It's the other half of the jacket at the Hyatt. Same maker. Look inside, same style number."
I might as well have been staring at $1 million in cash or a ton of stolen cocaine. I couldn't take my eyes off the pants, imagining how Nicholas Jenks would squirm now. Claire had been right. She'd been right from the start. The jacket hadn't come off the victim. It had always belonged to Jenks.
"So, what do you think, Inspector?" Charlie Clapper grinned. "Can you close your case or what?" "Oh, yeah," the CSU man exclaimed almost absent-mindedly. "Where'd I put it?"
He patted his pockets, searched around in his jacket. He finally found a small plastic bag.
"Straight out of the sucker's electric razor," Charlie announced.
In the bag were several short red hairs. Chapter 91. Claire said,
"I've been expecting you, honey."
She took my arm and led me back into the lab to a small room lined with chemicals. Two microscopes were set up side by side on a granite block counter.
"Charlie told me what he came up with," she said. "The champagne, matching pantalones, you got him, Lindsay."
"Match these," I held out the plastic bag. "We put him in the gas chamber."
"Okay, let's see," she said, smiling.
She opened a yellow envelope marked priority evidence, and took out a petri dish identical to the one I had seen after the second murders. It had "Subject, Rebecca DeGeorge, number 62340, written on the front in bold marker. With a tweezer, she placed the single hair that had come from the second bride onto a clear slide. Then she inserted it under the scope. She leaned over it, adjusting the focus, then caught me by surprise, asking,
"So, how you feeling, woman?"
"You mean Negley's?"
"What else would I mean?" she said, peering into the scope.
In the rush of apprehending Jenks, it was the first time in the past few days that I had really thought about it. "I saw Medved late last week. My blood count's still down." Claire finally looked up.
"I'm sorry, Lindsay."
Trying to sound upbeat, I walked her through my regimen. The increased dosage, the higher frequency. I mentioned the possibility of a bone marrow transplant. She flashed me a big smile.
"We're gonna have to find a way to get those red cells of yours shaken up."
Even in the laboratory, I must have started to blush.
"What?" asked Claire. "What are you hiding? Trying unsuccessfully to hide?"
"Nothing."
"Something's going on. Between you and Mr. Chris Rawley, I bet." "Come on, this is me you're talking to. You can't pull that blue wall of silence stuff."
I told her, from the first kiss at the precinct, to the slow, torturous ride home, to the burst of heat right there on the hallway rug. Claire grasped me by my shoulders. Her eyes were as bright and excited as mine.
"So?" "So," I laughed. "So? It was awesome. It was right."
I felt a chill of doubt come over me. "I just don't know if I'm doing the right thing, considering what's going on." I hesitated. "I could love him, Claire. Maybe I already do.
We stared at each other. There wasn't much more to say.
Well, Claire's eyes returned to her microscope. Let's see what we have here. Hairs from his chinny-chin-chin.
Three hairs from Jenks's razor were set on a cellular slide. She loaded it into a scope. The two scopes were side by side. Claire looked first, leaned over as she focused the new one in. Then she went back and forth.
Hmm.
Huh?
She uttered. I held my breath. What do you think? I asked.
You tell me.
I leaned in. Immediately I recognized the first hair, the one from inside Rebecca DeGeorge's vagina. Thick, reddish, a white filament twisted around its base like the coil of a snake. Then I looked at the hairs from Jenks's razor. There were three of them, shorter, clipped, but each had that same reddish hue, that same coil of filament around it. I was no expert, but there was no doubt in my mind. The hairs were a perfect match.
Chapter 92.
Nicholas Jenks was in a holding cell on the 10th floor of the Hall of Justice. He was headed to arraignment later today. His lawyer, Sherman Leff, was with him, looking as if this were all just a formality and the scales of justice were resting on the shoulders of his English-tailored suit. Jill Bernhardt accompanied Raleigh and me. Jenks had no idea what was coming his way. We had the champagne, the tuxedo pants, matching hairs from his beard. We had him in the suite with David and Melanie Brandt. I couldn't wait to tell him all the good news. I sat down across from Jenks and looked him in the eye.
This is Assistant District Attorney Jill Bernhardt, I said. She's going to be handling your case. She's going to convict you, too.
He smiled, the same gracious, confident, and condescending glint, as if he were receiving us in his home. Why does he look so confident, I wondered.
If it's all right, Jill said, I'd like to begin.
Your meeting, Sherman Leff said. I've no objection.
Jill took a breath.
Mr. Jenks, in an hour you are going to be arraigned for the first-degree murder of David and Melanie Brandt at the Grand Hyatt Hotel on June 5th. Shortly after, I believe a Cleveland court will do the same for the murders of James and Kathleen Voskuhl. Based on what the medical examiner has just uncovered, I believe you can expect a Napa Valley court to follow through as well. We have overwhelming evidence linking you to all three of these crimes. We are sharing this with you and with your counsel in the hope that your response to this evidence might spare the city, the families of the deceased, and your family the further humiliation of a trial.
Sherman Leff finally cut in.
Thank you, Miss Bernhardt. As long as consideration is the spirit of the day, we'd like to begin by expressing my client's deep regret for his emotional outburst toward Inspector Boxer at the time of his arrest. As you might imagine, the shock and the suddenness of such an accusation, so totally preposterous after he had fully complied with your questioning in his own home, I'm certain you can understand how the wrong emotions might take hold. I do deeply regret that, Inspector.
Jenks spoke up.
I realize how this must look. My being less than forthcoming about my relationship with one of the deceased. And now you seem to have stumbled upon that unfortunate book.
Which, Leff interjected, I must advise you, we will be making a motion to suppress. Obtaining it was an unjustified intrusion into my client's private domain.
The warrant was totally justified, Jill said calmly.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that your client gave false testimony concerning his whereabouts when Kathy Voskuhl was killed.
Leff hung in mid-motion, stunned. Your client was in Cleveland, Counselor, I sprang on him.
Then I said to Jenks, you were registered at the Westin. You stayed two nights, coinciding with the Voskuhl murders.
You said you were at home, Mr. Jenks, but you were there. And you were at the Hall of Fame.
Jenks's smile disappeared and his eyes flicked around the room. He swallowed, and I could see the knots sliding down his throat. He was retracing his alibis and lies. He looked at Leff somewhat apologetically.
I was there, he admitted. I did conceal it. As it happens, I was in town to address a local readers' group. You can check. The Argosy bookstore. I didn't know how to explain it.
coupled with knowing Kathy, it seemed so incriminating. But let me make this clear. You're wrong about the wedding. I was nowhere near it.
My blood rose. I couldn't believe this guy. You had a reading? When, Mr. Jenks?
Saturday afternoon, at 4, a small group of very loyal fans. The Argosy was very kind to me when I first started out.
And after that?
After that, I did what I always do. I stayed at the hotel and wrote. I took a swim, an early dinner. You can ask my wife. I always spend the evenings alone when I'm on the road. It's been written up in People magazine.
I leaned across the table. So this was all some bizarre coincidence, right? A woman with whom you've denied having a sexual relationship is brutally murdered. You just happen to be in town. You just happen to lie about the relationship and about being there. Your likeness just happens to be caught by a security camera at the scene. Is that how it goes, Mr. Jenks?
Leff placed a cautionary hand on Jenks's arm.
No!
His client snapped, his self-control clearly chipping away. Then he became calmer and wiped the sweat off his brow.
I lied. For Chessie. To preserve my marriage.
He straightened himself up in the wooden chair. His alibi was collapsing.
I'm not a perfect man, Inspector. I slip. I deceived you about Kathy. It was wrong. The answer is yes. What you assume to be true is true. We were lovers, on and off, for 5 years. It continued well into her relationship with James. It was folly. It was the desperate thrill of a fool, but it was not murder. I did not kill Kathy, and I did not kill the others.
Jenks stood up. For the first time he looked scared. The reality of what was happening was clearly sinking in. I leaned forward and said, A bottle of champagne was left in the suite at the Hyatt where the Brants were killed. It matched the same lot you purchased at an auction at Butterfield & Butterfield in November 1996. Leff objected.
We know that. Surely the unfortunate coincidence of my client's taste in champagne doesn't implicate him in this act. He didn't even know the Brants. That wine could have been purchased anywhere.
It could have, yes. However, the registration number on the bottle from the Hyatt matched those from the rest of the lot we uncovered at your home last night.
This is getting absurd, Jenks said angrily. This sort of bullshit wouldn't even make one of my books.
Hopefully this will be better, then.
From under the table, I pulled out the Nordstrom's shopping bag holding the balled-up tuxedo pants. I tossed them onto the table in front of everybody. You recognize these?
Pants. What kinds of games are we playing now?
These were found last night, in this bag, in the back of your bedroom closet.
So? What are you saying, they're mine? Joseph avowed they could be. I don't understand where you're going.
Where I'm going is that these pants match the tuxedo jacket that was found in the Brant's suite. They're a suit, Mr. Jenks.
A suit?
It's the pants to the jacket you left in their hotel room. Same brand, same style number, same size.
A deepening panic began to sweep over his face.
And if all this still falls short of your usual material, I said, fixing on his eyes, then how's this? The hair matched.
The hair you left inside Becky DeGeorge. With hairs taken from your house. It belonged to you. You animal. You convicted yourself. Jill leaned forward. You're going away, Jenks. You're going away until the appeals finally run out and they come to stick a loaded needle in your arm.
This is insane, he cried.
He was leaning over me, veins in his neck swelling, shouting in my face.
You bitch! You're setting me up! You fucking ice bitch! I didn't kill anyone!
Suddenly I found that I couldn't move. Seeing Jenks unwind was one thing, but there was something else going on. I felt pinned to my chair. I knew, but I couldn't fight it. Negley's. I finally got up and went to the door, but my head swirled and the room tilted. My legs began to buckle.
Not here, I begged.
Then I felt Raleigh supporting me. Lindsay, you all right? He was looking at me, worried, unsuspecting. I saw Jill there, too. You all right, Lindsay? I leaned against the wall. I willed my legs to work.
I'm okay,
I whispered, holding onto Raleigh's arm. I just hate that bastard, I said, and walked out of the interrogation room. I was very weak, swaying. I barely made it to the ladies' room. I felt faint, then nauseated, as if some angry spirit were trying to claw out of my lungs. I closed my eyes, leaned over the sink. I coughed, a raw, burning stinging in my chest. Then I shook and coughed some more. Gradually, I felt the spell recede. I took a breath, opened my eyes. I shuddered. There was blood all over the sink. Chapter 93. 4 hours later, in district criminal court, I felt well enough to watch Nicholas Jenks be arraigned for murder. A buzzing crowd filled the halls outside the courtroom of Judge Stephen Bowen. Photographers flashed cameras blindly. Reporters surged for a glimpse of the sullen, shaken, best-selling writer. Raleigh and I squeezed through, took a seat behind Jill in the front row. My strength having returned, the riot in my chest subsided. I wanted Jenks to see me there. I saw Cindy sitting in the press section, and in the back of the courtroom I spotted Chancellor Weil and his wife. It was over before it began. Jenks was led in, his eyes as dead and hollow as craters on the moon. The clerk read the docket, the suspect rose. The bastard pleaded not guilty. What were they going to argue, that all the evidence was inadmissible? Leff, the consummate showman, was unusually respectful, even demure, before Judge Bowen. He made a pleading case for release on recognizance based on Jenks's stature in the community. For a moment, the killer's accomplishments almost even swayed me. Jill fought him head-on. She graphically detailed the savagery of the murders. She argued that the suspect had the means and the lack of roots to flee. I felt a surge of triumph rippling through me when the judge struck his gavel and intoned, "Bail denied!" Chapter 94. Now we were celebrating. It was the end of the day, a day I had long waited for, and I met the girls for a drink at Susie's. We had earned this. Nicholas Jenks had been arraigned. No bail, no consideration of the court. The four of us had pulled it off. "Here's to the Women's Murder Club," Cindy cheered with her beer mug in the air. "Not bad for a collection of gender-impaired public servants," Claire agreed. "What did Jenks call me?" I shook my head and smiled. "A fucking ice bitch?" "I can do ice bitch," Jill said, grinning. "To the ice bitches of the world," Cindy toasted, "and the men who cannot thaw us out."
"Speak for yourself," said Claire. "Edmund thaws me just fine."
We all laughed and clinked beers. "Still," I said, letting out a deep breath, "I'd like to turn up a murder weapon. And I want to nail him to the second crime." "When I'm through with him," Jill tugged at her beer and said, "you won't have to worry about him serving time for the second crime." "You see Jill chop down his lawyer's bail request?" Cindy said with admiration. "You see the look on his face?" She made her fingers into a scissors. Snip, 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 snip. Straight for the testicles. That man was left standing there in his suit with a 2-inch dick. We all laughed. Cindy's cherubic nose twisted as she said, "Snip, snip, snip." "Still," I said, "without a weapon, his motive still needs work."
"Damn his motive, child," Claire exclaimed. "Let well enough alone."
Jill agreed. "Why can't his motive simply be that he's a sick bastard? He's had a history of sexual sadism for years. He's brutalized 3 women that we know of. I'm sure more will come out as the trial moves on." "You saw the bastard, Lindsay," she went on. "He's crazed. His little perfect world gets rocked. He goes insane. This morning he looked like he was about to plant a death grip on your throat." She grinned toward the group. Lindsay just sort of glares up at him like, "Get the fuck out of my face." They were about to raise a glass to me, the tough hero cop who would always carry the tag that she was the one who nailed Jenks, when the realization shot through me that I could never have done it without them. It wasn't my steel nerves that had taken over in the interrogation room, but the grip of my disease, squeezing my energy. I had kept it concealed, never shared, even with the ones who had become my closest friends. That wasn't about Jenks, I said.
Sure seemed like it.
I don't mean the confrontation. I mean what happened after. I paused. When I almost collapsed. That wasn't about Jenks.
They were still smiling, except Claire, but one by one the gravity in my eyes alerted them. I looked around the table and told them about the Pac-Man-like disease that was eating my red blood cells, and that I'd been fighting it for 3 weeks now. Packed red cell transfusions. My blood count was deteriorating. I was getting worse. I started strong, my voice firm, because it had been part of my life for several weeks now, but when I finished, I was speaking in a hushed, scared tone. I was blinking back tears. Jill and Cindy just sat there, rocked in disbelieving silence. Then there were three hands reaching out for me. Cindy's, Jill's, then, last and warmest, Claire's. For a long time, no one said anything. They didn't have to. Finally, I smiled, choking back tears. Isn't it just like a cop to go and shut down a party just when it's going good? It broke the tension, cut through the sudden pall. They never said, "We're with you." They never told me, "You're gonna be all right." They didn't have to. "We're supposed to be celebrating," I said. Then I heard Jill's voice out of the blue, solemn, confessing. "When I was a little girl, I was real sick. I was in a brace and hospitals between the ages of 4 and 7. It broke my parents, their marriage. They split up as soon as I got better. I guess that's why I felt I had to be stronger and better than anyone else, why I always had to win. It started in high school," Jill went on. I wasn't sure what she was referring to. "I didn't know if I would be good enough. I used to..." She unbuttoned the cuffs of her blouse, rolled the sleeves up over her elbows. "I've never showed these to anybody, except Steve." Her arms were marked with scars. I knew what they were. Self-inflicted slashes. Jill had been a cutter. What I meant to say was, you just have to fight it. You fight it, and fight it, and fight it. And every time you feel it getting stronger, you fight it some more. "I'm trying," I whispered, my voice choking. "I really am trying." Now I knew what propelled her, what was behind that icy gaze. "But how?" Jill's hands were holding mine. There were tears in both our eyes. "It's like with Jenks, Lindsay," she said. "You just don't let it win." Chapter 95. In the cold, cramped cell, Nicholas Jenks paced anxiously. He felt as if dynamite were about to explode at the center of his chest. He hadn't done anything. How could they destroy his name, attack him with those wild fictions, disgrace him all over the news? It was dark, and he was freezing. The cot in his jail cell wasn't fit for a monk. He was still in the damp clothes they had brought him in. A cold, unrepentant sweat began to break out on his palms. He'd make the little inspector bitch pay. One way or another, he'd get her in the end. That was a promise. What was his fucking poodle of a lawyer doing? When would Lef get him out of there? It was as if all reason had been sucked out of his world. What the hell was going on? Or at least, Philip Campbell thought, that's what Jenks ought to be feeling. What he thought the bastard would be saying in his mind. Campbell sat in front of the mirror. "Time for you to go away. Your work is finally done. The last chapter's been written." He dabbed a wet cloth in a bowl of warm water. It was the last time he would ever have to play the part. "So, how does it feel, Nicholas?" He pulled out the pins that held his hair and let his locks shake out. "How does it feel to be a victim, a prisoner, to feel the same degradation and shame you cast on others?"
Slowly he wiped the dark makeup off his eyes, dabbing with the cloth, feeling a sheen begin to return to his face. How does it feel to be helpless and alone, to be kept in a dark space, to feel betrayed? One by one, Philip Campbell tugged at the hairs of the reddish beard on his chin, until they came out, and a new person was revealed. Not able to recognize in the mirror the person you once were? Scrubbing the face until it came out clean and smooth, unbuttoning the shirt, Nicholas's shirt, and soon, from underneath a bodysuit, a well-defined woman's body came to life. The outline of breasts, shapely legs, arms rippling with lean strength. She sat there, newly revealed, a bright glow in her eyes. This is rich. How does it feel, Nicholas, to be royally fucked? The tables turned for once. She couldn't restrain the thought that it was fitting and funny that in the end he had been trapped by his own twisted mind. It was more than funny. It was absolutely brilliant. Who's laughing now, Nick? Book 4. The Whole Truth. Chapter 96. The night following Jenks's arraignment, Chief Mercer had gotten the skybox at Packbell from one of his wealthy buddies. He invited several of us, including me, Raleigh, and Cheery, to a Giants game. It was a warm summer evening. They were playing the cards. My father would have loved it. I didn't really want to go, didn't want to feel on display as the cop who'd caught Jenks, but Mercer pressed. And it was Mark McGuire and all, so I put on a windbreaker and went along for the ride. All evening long, Chris and I kept sneaking looks at each other. There was a special energy in the box, a glowing ring around just him and me. The game was background noise. In the third, Mighty Mac hit one off Gardner that went out of sight and almost landed in the bay. The stadium cheered wildly, even for a card. In the fourth, Barry Bonds tied it with a shot of his own. Chris and I couldn't stop watching each other. We had our legs up on the same chair, like school kids, and every once in a while our calves brushed together. Jesus, this was better than the ball game. Finally, he winked at me. Want something to drink? He said. He went over to the bowl of drinks, which was elevated from the seats, and I followed. The others didn't look back. As soon as we were out of sight, he placed his hands on my thighs and kissed me. I felt on fire. You want to hang around? Still beer left, I joked. His hand brushed against the side of my breast, and I felt a tremor. Soft hands. My breath quickened. A flicker of sweat broke through on my neck. Chris kissed me again. He drew me in close, and I felt the cadence of a heart pounding between us. I didn't know if it was his or mine. Can't wait, he said. Okay, let's get out of here. No, he shook his head. I meant, I can't wait. Oh, Jesus, I sighed. I couldn't hold back. My whole body was heating up to the boiling point. I glanced down at Cheery and Mercer and the two Mill Valley types. This is crazy, Lindsay. But everything lately was crazy. Everything speeding out of control. It seemed as if every natural force in the universe was driving Chris and me to find a secluded spot. There was a bathroom in the skybox, barely large enough to put on makeup in. We didn't care. Chris led me into the bathroom while the baseball crowd roared at something. We could barely squeeze in. Jesus, I could not believe I was doing this here. He unbuttoned my blouse. I unfastened his belt. Our thighs were pressed tightly together. Gently, Chris lifted me onto him. I felt as if a shooting star had exploded in my veins. Chris was up against the counter. I was in the palms of his hands. We were squeezed into this tiny space, but we were in a perfect rhythm. A crowd roar echoed in from outside. Maybe McGuire had hit another, maybe Bonds had robbed him. Who cared? We kept rocking, Chris and I. I couldn't breathe. My body was slick with sweat. I couldn't stop. Chris kept it going. I gripped on tight, and in a moment we both gasped. Two hero cups, I thought. It was the best, the freest, the most excited I had ever felt. Chris rested his forehead on my shoulder. I kissed his cheek, his neck. Then the strangest thought took hold of me. I began to laugh, a mixture of laughter and exhausted sighs. We were pinned there, spent, a few feet from my boss. I was giggling like a damn fool. I was going to get us caught.
"What's so funny?" Chris whispered.
I was thinking of Claire and Cindy, and what we had just done. "I think I just made the list," I said.
Chapter 97. The next day, Jenks asked to meet again. Jill and I went to see him on the 10th floor. We wondered what was up. This time there was no cat and mouse, no bullshit at all. Leff was there, but he rose, humbly, as soon as we came in. Jenks looked far less threatening in his gray prison garb. The worried look on his face was a clear message. "My client wants to make a statement," Leff announced as soon as we sat down. I was thinking, this is it. He wants to make a deal. He's seen how ridiculous it is to play this game. But he came out with something unexpected.
"I'm being framed," Jenks announced angrily.
It took about half a second for Jill's glance to bump into mine.
"I have to hear this again," she said. "What's going on?"
She looked at Jenks, then at Leff.
"We've got your client tied to all three crime scenes. We've got him in Cleveland at the time of the last murder. We've got him lying about a prior relationship with Kathy Kogut, one of the last victims. We've got his book detailing an astonishingly similar criminal pattern. We've got his facial hairs matched to one found in another victim's vagina. And you're claiming he's being framed?"
"What I'm claiming," Jenks said, ashen-faced, "is that I'm being set up."
"Listen, Mr. Jenks," Jill said, still looking at Leff, "I've been doing this 8 years. I've built cases on hundreds of criminals, put over 50 murderers behind bars myself. I've never seen such a preponderance of evidence implicating a suspect. Our case is so airtight it can't breathe."
"I realize that," Jenks sighed,
"and that I've given you every reason to find my plea implausible. I've lied about being in Cleveland, my relationship with Kathy. On the others, I can't even account for my whereabouts.
But I also know setups. I've mapped out more of them than anybody. I'm a master at this, and I assure you, someone is setting me up." I shook my head with disbelief.
"Who, Mr. Jenks?"
Jenks sucked in a long breath. He actually looked scared.
"I don't know."
"Someone hates you enough to set all this up?" Jill couldn't hold back a snicker. "The little I know of you, I might buy that." She turned to Leff.
"You looking forward to presenting this case?"
"Just hear him out, Ms. Bernhardt," the lawyer pleaded.
"Look," Jenks said, "I know what you think of me. I'm guilty of many things. Selfishness, cruelty, adultery. I have a temper. Sometimes I can't hold it in. And with women, you can probably line up a dozen of them who would help put me away for these murders. But clear as that is, I did not kill these people. Any of them. Someone is trying to set me up. That's the truth. Someone has done a brilliant job."
Chapter 98.
"You buy any of that shit?"
Jill smirked at me as we waited for the elevator outside Jenks's holding cell.
"I might buy that he somehow believes it," I told her. "Give me a break! He'd be better off going for insanity. If Nicholas Jenks wants to narrow down a list of people who might want to set him up, he might as well start with anyone he ever fucked."
I laughed, agreeing that the list would be long. Then the elevator door opened, and to my surprise, out walked Chessie Jenks. She was dressed in a long taupe summer dress. I immediately noticed how pretty she was. Our eyes met in an awkward, silent moment. I had just arrested her husband. My crime scene team had ripped apart her house. She would have every reason to look at me with complete disdain. But she didn't.
"I'm here to see my husband," she said in a shaky voice.
I stiffly introduced her to Jill, then I pointed her to the visiting area. At that moment, she seemed about as alone and confused as anyone I had ever seen.
"Sherman tells me there's a lot of evidence," she said.
I nodded politely. I don't know why I felt something for her, other than she seemed a young, vulnerable woman whose fate had been to fall in love with a monster.
"Nick didn't do this, Inspector," Jessie Jenks said.
Her outburst surprised me. It's only natural for a wife to want to defend her husband, I